Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
Are listening to Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a podcast about Linux, open source, and amateur radio for everyone. Now here are your hosts, Russ, K52UX, Cheryl, W5MOO, and Bill, NE4RD.
Well, hello everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 535 of Linux in the Ham Shack, the most terrific amateur radio podcast on the internet. We welcome you into our short topics episode, and we're certainly glad that you're here. So we're going to probably just go ahead and roll on into our topics. But before we do that, we'll introduce ourselves. For the on assignment, Cheryl, W5MOO. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD.
And for the first time in a long time, we have a lead topic for tonight. And it's a topic that we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on because I'm sure everybody's heard it 1,000 times at this point. But I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention it at all. And that is that founder of Heil Sound and amateur radio pillar of the community and all of that good stuff, Bob Heil, K9EID, passed away a couple of days ago. And Bill found a statement from Heil Ham Radio about this, and I guess I'll let you go ahead and read it because you probably have a little more knowledge of the text here.
Sure, I can read it. Yeah. Our beloved founder, Dr. Bob Heil, K9EID, is now a silent key. Bob fought a valiant year-long battle with cancer and passed peacefully surrounded by his family. Bob's lifelong passion for amateur radio was clear to everyone involved in the hobby. Everything Bob did for the betterment and growth of the amateur radio, from his instructional handbooks and countless presentations to his support of the ARRL and youth programs, was based on the foundation and spirit of service. Bob was an Elmer to all of us. While Bob's presence will be dearly missed, his impact on the hobby and everyone in it will be felt, will forever be felt. On behalf of Bob to all ham radio operators in the world, 73.
All right, very good. And Bob actually, as we've mentioned before, lived not too far from us here in northern Missouri. He's obviously not from here, but that's where he was living at the time. I don't think he moved away. I could be wrong about that. And he was actually a member of one of the local clubs here that I'm also a member of. So, and, you know, he certainly was at some of the local ham fest, and I would, you know, briefly talk to Bob here and there as he wandered around, since he was kind of local to me and I was kind of local to him. So, yeah, and even it didn't really matter how small the amateur radio event was. He was there if he could. So he even showed up at some of the club like tech days and stuff. So I know everyone will miss him. And of course, outside of his amateur radio, you know, interests, he was also a sound engineer, audio engineer, and did a lot of work in the world of music. So particularly rock music. And it's probably the reason that Joe Walsh is a ham. So
yes,
I suspect that that's probably true. But anyway, that's a sad day for Bob Heil and everyone who knew him, which is a whole lot of people. So, and with that, let's go ahead and get on into some amateur radio topics. And since I've been doing some POTA lately, I guess I'll go ahead and read this first one because it's interesting to me.
It's precious to me. Yep.
POTA change is coming. The Parks on the Air documentation outlines updates to its database to accommodate growth and global coverage. These changes involve reorganizing programs, locations, DX entities, and parks based on ISO 3166-2 standards and the ARRL DXCC list. The updates aim to resolve inconsistencies and improve accuracy, including adjustments to program names, codes, park reference codes, and location details. Additionally, quality control efforts are ongoing with volunteers updating park names, types, and geographical data. These modifications will be noticeable through updated park codes, potential reassignment of awards. Oh no, Howard. and the requirement for some time to reflect changes in statistics and metrics. For more detailed information, you can visit the Parks on the Air documentation. Some have already noticed the Parks in Canada switching from VE to CA. That is one thing I have definitely noticed. And we'll be seeing the K-labeled parks in the U.S. to U.S. Interesting. In general...
You can tell I did that. That was me.
In general, there will be nothing for users to do, although logging software developers are recommended to implement updates regularly to handle these changes. Very good. That came from the POTA application documentation directly. So that's interesting. That's cool. Yeah, I have noticed that the VEs have switched to CAs in a lot of cases, although I have still heard Canadian parks use the VE nomenclature as of a couple of days ago. So and it will definitely be different to see K switch to US, because that's, of course, where most of the parks are that I work, but probably makes perfect sense. Because didn't this stem from, like, it was NPOTA before, so it was just here in the US, and that's probably why it used K, and now that it's become global, it makes sense to broaden the tags. So
yeah, I believe so. I believe that's correct to how that started. And yeah, I mean, the Summits on the Air is kind of the precursor to all of this. So I mean, they could have taken some ideas from them as well, but they're also a little weird because they go by states and stuff like that. So there's a lot of state codes and summit codes and everything else. So you get, like, you know, MT blah blah for Montana something. Yeah, it gets confusing. And, you know, it's more confusing for the developers that have to update drop down lists and stuff like that in their logging software for the users to pre-populate the list. You know, you might see some cases where they just say, well, here's your text field, have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the cloud log kind of just does use a text field, but it does keep track of POTA as an award category. One thing I will say about POTA that I really kind of like is it's kind of like how baseball is the only sport where the defense controls the ball. In the POTA world, all the award tracking and hunter tracking and all that kind of stuff is done by the park operators, the people who activate.
The activators, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of nice. I mean, of course, I keep track of all my logs and everything on my side too, but you don't have to worry about that in the world of POTA. The activators keep track of all that for you, and if you use the POTA.app site and log into that, then when they upload their logs, then all your logs get updated, and you know, you get awards and you know, all that kind of stuff, and you don't really have to worry about it, so... Pretty cool. I like it. POTA is cool. I strive to do POTA every day. I have not been successful in that, but I do usually get 3 or 4 a day. So anyway, there you go. And you don't work POTA. Oh, you said you were working the DX using your voice keyer.
Oh, yeah. I was using the voice keyer for the ARRL DX single sideband competition this weekend, just briefly. I think I only worked like 10 or 11 contacts, so.
Yeah, I think I worked 11 or 12 today, just like in the matter of a few minutes. I got onto 15 meters and just started jumping onto pileups and managed to work them. I was using CloudLog as a contest logger. It actually works really well.
Oh, cool. Well, this is an easy exchange, so it, you know, this I would say this one doesn't count.
Well, that's true. I guess I'll try another one whenever another one comes up that's not like a CW contest. But I mean, I'm liking the way it works. I mean, I could use not one at MM because at least the WFD logger and stuff like that that K6 GTE has developed will integrate with CloudLog. I don't know if that's the case with not one MM yet, but I could use either one, I suppose. And
I mean, all you have to do is export and then import. I mean,
Right, but CloudLog is nice about the fact that even if you look at the manifest, it shows the exchanges in your logging, in your public log and stuff, which is kind of cool. I like it.
Okay.
All right. Well, I guess you can let's talk about some money, huh? Money we're
not
making.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Okay, so this is I got an email that said the ARDC's annual report was released. So I read through it, and I decided just to throw a quick little summary here. Highlights provided by the executive director, Rosie Schechter, KJ7RYV, summarizes the activity of the ARDC quite well. Rosie is proud of Rhea Hiram, N2RJ, joining the board of directors and adding tremendous experience and expertise to the leadership team. The ARDC approved over 65 grants and charitable gifts, totaling about $5.3 million. The tech team and technical advisory committee made tremendous progress toward advancing policies and projects to enhance the usage of 44.0 or 44.net. And the ARDC also launched new and responsive website. Hey, hey, hey. A final project of Dan Romachek, KB6NU, before he retired. So way to go, Dan. Leave him with new and responsive websites. Didn't know you were a developer. That's great. grants. So this is a grant breakdown for 2023. Amateur radio grants were totaled up to $1.5 million, which was about 28.6% of the total grants. Education was $1 million, about 20%. Scholarships was another $1 million, about 19%. And research and development got $1.6 million, 31.7% of the share. So most of the money went into R&D, which is really good, and amateur radio. So that's always good to see. And it looks like a good spend and stuff like that. The ARDC also announced a VPN service to deploy some of the 44Net addresses. This is not released as of yet, but there is some information available. There was a short video that someone did on YouTube. I linked that in the show notes here. That was done at Hamcation. I believe they're using the WireGuard protocol to actually do this. So I'm kind of wondering if they... someone heard me or like was ringing in their ears that like they needed to just use basically tail scale or tail scale, like, or what was the other, head scale, your own VPN service using WireGuard,
right?
So looks like they have a device that they're using, an off-the-shelf device, so you can purchase it from Amazon or something like that they mentioned in the video. And then I think they're having basically a firmware or software that will get you all set up to connect your 44Net addresses into the cloud. So to be on the lookout for that. Check out the ARDC's annual report. It gives a full list of details and everything else. As for like the extended financials, those won't be available until the 990s done, much like any nonprofit. So always wait out for that before you say anything about the finances of the organization. The 990 tells all, and those will always be available for everyone to look at. So good job there, team at the ARDC. I think they're doing a great job.
All right, very good. ARDC doing what the ARDC does, making the world better in ham radio. And interestingly, I was working on setting up my 3D printer area yesterday, so I got that up, and I have the computer set up and everything, and this was a perfect use case for tail scale, because there's only one computer over there, and it controls all the printers, but that the house next door is actually on a different DSL connection, so it's not connected here. I don't have the houses wired together. So tail scale was perfect. Put the computer over there on tail scale, connect to it via RDP, and do everything I want as if it was on the same network.
Imagine that. Isn't it great?
It is wonderful. And as easy as it is to set up, which is basically download the software and run it, I mean, it's couldn't get any better. All right. Well, that's actually all we have in the world of amateur radio for tonight. Obviously, there's more to talk about, but nothing particularly interesting. It's kind of a slow news week, which is fine. I mean, we did put out an hour-long episode last time, so we're undercompensating this time around. So for open source, though, we do have a couple of topics to talk about. The first one is the HDMI forum is rejecting open source HDMI 2.1 driver support sought by AMD, Advanced Micro Devices. One of the limitations of AMD's open source Linux graphics driver has been the inability to implement HDMI 2.1 plus functionality on the basis of legal requirements by the HDMI forum. AMD engineers had been working to come up with a solution in conjunction with the HDMI forum for being able to provide HDMI... Wow. How many times are we saying HDMI in this story?
At least 7 or 8 times.
Okay, good. Because I want to make sure that I'm ready.
We should just start doing Hidmi or something like that. Or
Hidmi. With their open source Linux kernel driver, but it looks like those efforts for now have concluded and failed. Fail. For 3 years, there has been a bug report around 4K at 120 Hz being unavailable via Hidmi 2.1 and on the EMDA Linux driver. Similarly, there have been bug reports like 5K at 240 Hz not possible either with the AMDA graphics driver on Linux. AMDA Linux engineers have spent months working with their legal team and evaluating all Hidmi features to determine if how they can be exposed in their open source driver. AMDA had code working internally, and then the past few months were waiting on approval from the Hidmi forum. Sadly, the Hidmi forum has turned down AMDA's request for open source driver support. EMDA Linux engineer Alex Deutscher commented on the ticket. The Hademi, he didn't say Hademi.
Just skip to the bottom where it starts to say, needless to say.
Needless to say, open source Linux advocates should try to use DisplayPort instead, if at all possible.
So yeah, so basically the group that controls the proprietary connectors, blobbity blah, for HDMI 2.1 plus is not allowing them to open source their implementation or expose their implementation in open source so that it can be in the kernel, so people can have their HDMI plugged into their fancy AMD graphics card into very high definition devices, 4K and up, basically. Yeah, use DisplayPort.
you know who can see 500 or 5K at 240 hertz? Nobody. Nobody can see that resolution.
Well, they think they can. They're paying for it, though. You know, that's the thing. Is that, gee, that's like an extra selling feature. I'm going to have my 120 hertz screen, and I can see it.
The hell you can. Yeah, no one. The only thing that, like, even at, you know, 4K, I don't think 4K video looks any better to me than 1080p.
And, oh, I hate 4K video. I hate 4K video. I think
especially, well, I hate horrible. Any video that's at higher than you know, that's at like 120 hertz, because it looks weird. Yeah. I mean, it's just
4K with a little dithering on a huge screen, like a screen that's way too big to be 4K. That's probably okay. But like when you're seeing every single pixel at 4K, yeah, it looks ugly.
Yeah, it is no good. Sure, push to technology, I suppose. But honestly, it doesn't help. I mean, the human eye just can't parse these ridiculous resolutions and frame rates. So whatever. Anyway.
So yeah, DisplayPort. Use your display ports, use NVIDIA. Oh, not NVIDIA. Oh, my God. Never. But I don't have that problem here. So, but I am using my display port to the screen, and the HDMI actually goes to the HDMI capture because it's an HDMI capture card.
So. And one thing they don't sort of mention, like if you have a satellite TV service that offers 4K.
Yeah.
Just be aware that 4K video kind of exceeds the bandwidth allowed by satellite video download. So you're going to get like immediate blockiness and pixelation. Yeah. The picture is going to be nice and clear when there's no motion.
Oh yeah. They're highly compressed.
Highly compressed. Yeah. So yeah, it's just stupid. Anyway, let's talk about KDE.
Hey, KDE mega release 6. This is awesome. The KDE community has released Mega Release 6 featuring Plasma 6, Frameworks 6, and Gear 24.02. This update includes significant upgrades like transitioning to the latest Qt version, Qt 6, and migrating to Wayland, although it works fine in X11, enhancing security, efficiency, and performance. New features include an improved overview effect, partial HDR support on Wayland, color blindness correction filters, a new Scarlet Tree wallpaper, that's probably the coolest thing, and floating panels. Changes also encompass single click to select files. I hate that. Enable touch to tap to click by default. That should be default. That's annoying that touchpads are not set up automatically that way. And let's see, Wayland as the default session. A lot of people won't be happy about that. Breeze and various applications have been redesigned for a more modern appearance and better usability. The big news, I added this part to it, but it's also in the site news there. The big news for KDE's powerful video editor, KDN Live, is support for replacing the audio or video of a clip in a timeline. This new feature allows you to extract the audio of a clip, modify it in another program, then update the existing clip with the new audio. Some would think that that's pretty trivial and already easy to do, and surprisingly, it is not. I have had to do this myself many times, and it's a bit ugly, and then things get out of sync. This is especially useful for videos that demand subtitles in several languages. KDE has further enhanced its subtitle feature, allowing you to incorporate multiple subtitles onto a single track. This is especially useful for videos that demand subtitles in several languages. You also have the option to import and export subtitles. KDN Live will automatically let you know when there is an update available without even requiring an internet connection. That's interesting. The clip monitor will list the recently opened clips, and the document checker dialog that appears when opening a project with missing clips has been completely rewritten, and that's also good. So a lot of fun new things are being updated in all of the applications that support the various KDE programs. And I'm very happy that KDN Live is getting some love in this release, and I'm sure you probably don't have to have KDE Plasma installed for it, because I don't on the computer. I actually do most of my video editing on. So yeah, this is great news. I noticed that it's not going to be in the LTS, because OMG Ubuntu reported that it will not be included in the LTS release. So if you're expecting this to be in Ubuntu's 24.04, or is that right? 24.04 release, it will not make it into it. So I believe if you want it in that, you'll have to sideload it via a PPA. And I noticed on my Garuda installation that has KDE, it has not updated to 6 either yet. So I'm not sure. You have KDE on your system, right?
No, I do not.
Oh, okay, never mind. Oh, you're on Bodhi, that's right. Never mind.
Sorry, I'm using Moksha.
Moksha.
Enlightenment.
Yes, yes. So you probably won't. Doesn't matter to you.
Oh, it doesn't matter to me at all, unless I decide to do something with 24.04 and KDE. So
yeah, I think Ubuntu is prepping it to be in 24.10. So it'll be in one of the interim releases. So that's when they'll actually put 6 in there by default for at least the KDE version, the Kubuntu, I guess that would be.
All right, very good. So that's all we have for stories. So woo-hoo! I just threw in a Linux in the Ham Shack topic here because we didn't really have anything. And I just want to talk for a couple of minutes about a topic that will probably become a deep dive in the future. I have a couple of SDRs here in the house, RTL SDRs specifically. I know Bill has an RTL SDR and maybe another kind, I don't remember. We talk, here and there about applications for SDR, like GQRX and SDR++ and SDR Angel and Qt SDR, and the list goes on and on. There are quite a few of them. Those are great for a specific kind of SDR use, particularly with SDR receivers. They give you the ability to watch your SDR, to look at your passband, see what's on it. You get your waterfalls, your visualizations. Usually what happens, at least in my house, when I fire up an SDR, is the first thing I do is go to the broadcast FM band and listen to music for a few minutes, which I kind of suspect happens a lot, because it's one of the easiest things to find and decode using an SDR. But of course, SDRs are much more interesting than that. You can listen to like ADS-B traffic or decode ADS-B traffic. You can, decode basically anything that's on the airwaves. But in order to do that, you generally need some other kind of application, because you're not just listening to like a narrowband or a wideband FM signal, or, listening to HF somewhere around the world using your SDR while you tune around on your HF rig or what have you. One of the things that I was trying to be able to do with my SDR was use it as an old school like police scanner, which you can do. A lot of services these days are still using narrowband FM. They don't require any particular decoders. You can listen to them just like you can listen to any 2-meter amateur radio repeater. A lot of these services exist in the 150 and 160 megahertz range. But for reasons, a lot of these services have switched to other technologies. They use like NXDN, they use P25, they even use C4 FM. Some of them have gone to channeling systems with trunks and control channels. So they do frequency spectrum hopping and stuff like that. This is a technology, or this is a method of listening that's not covered by the technologies that we've listed, like GQRX and SDR++ and stuff like that. But there is an application called SDR Trunk, which is written by Dennis Shirer, and it allows you to do that. It has the means for controlling RTL SDRs and all the other kinds of SDRs, like things that are controlled by SOAPy, GNU Radio, AirSpy, all that kind of stuff. It allows you to put in these trunk systems and also just regular, narrowband FM signals and whatnot. You can even listen to the broadcast FM band if you want to. But if your municipalities and local county agencies and stuff like that use trunk systems, or they use P25 or stuff like that, and you want to be able to decode it, then you can use SDR Trunk for that. And again, this will become a deep dive episode where I go into a lot of details about how you do all this stuff. This is just kind of like an overview if anyone wants to explore it. It uses a decoder library that's written by Dennis as well. The whole application is written in Java, which, you know, on the minus side is it's in Java, and on the plus side, it's cross-platform. You can use it in Windows, Linux, and Mac OS, which I think has created a use now for my old Mac Mini. It's not going to become my my SDR decoder. And it also, it interfaces with a resource called Radio Reference. Are you familiar with Radio Reference?
I'm vaguely familiar with it. Like Rig Reference?
No, it's Radio Reference. RadioReference.com. This is one of the things that underpins or is linked to, this is like linked to Broadcastify in some way. And what it is the clearinghouse. It's a database of all radio frequencies, like organized by country, municipality, county, blah, 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 blah. And this functionality or this database can be linked into SDR trunk. So if you want to know what agencies have stuff on frequencies in your county, for example, you can use Radio Reference to look them all up, and it will actually populate and pre-program where to have your SDR tune and decode. It's pretty cool. I'm liking it. It can link multiple SDRs, and there's a reason why that's important, which we'll get into in the deep dive part. But if anyone wants to explore this kind of usage of software-defined radio, I definitely encourage checking out SDR Trunk. It's a matter of having a Java runtime environment, downloading the build, and running it. No compiling. Oh, something we'll talk about in the future, but I'm enjoying it. It takes a little getting used to. It's different than other SDR apps. It works well once you figure it out. And again, when we get to the deep dive, I'll walk you through how to actually figure it out when we get there. So that's all I pretty much have to say about SDR Trunk. You got anything else?
No. Just trying to figure out how to export my log from not 1mm. It's just like not giving me any indication that it's doing anything, and it's I don't know where it's actually trying to put a file. So interesting.
Mike's probably in the chat somewhere. Just
Mike. Mike,
yeah, help me.
Come save me.
What's wrong with your app?
Yeah, I know. I've done it before, and yeah, I must be having a brain fart.
Yeah, it's usually he's a pretty straightforward and simple kind of guy when it comes to coding.
So. Oh, here it is. Okay, I see it now. It's in my home directory. It's just putting it somewhere. Just your home directory, somewhere, right? Weird.
Yeah, it's not in like dot local share subdirectory something dot ADI.
Yes, no, it's actually all names right. It myself.
All right, folks. Well, that brings us down to the end of our topics for tonight. We do have one announcement. That is, of course, our rolling announcement here of the Linux in the Ham Shack Hamvention GoFundMe. It is live. We're over 50% funded. A few more donations probably will be all we need to get to the top. And, of course, we will hopefully see everybody out in Xenia in mid-May. We're looking forward to it. And thanks for donating. And either way, please go ahead and share as much as you can. All those social media networks and your ham clubs or anywhere you think somebody might have a couple of dollars of pocket change. We could really appreciate the financial little boost that we need to make Hamvention happen. And with that, I guess we'll come down to the new subscriber supporters and live participants. And since Cheryl's not here, I guess I'm going to task Bill with trying to get through this list.
Alrighty. This episode, we had no new subscribers or Patreons. We did have on Facebook, Tony Crosetto joined us. On Instagram, CE3BLO joined us. On YouTube, Anthony Jones joined us. And on Discord, we had quite a few pop in here. We have VA Radiating Whimsy, Brandon, Joseph, N5Y or WY, Ezra, Sam Young, 91210. Is that like almost like 90210? 91210. It must be a zip code still, right? MCD Perez, Oluwa Danny Young, and Aaron with a ERYNNE. And on the mailing list, we had MMC Crystal join us. And on the live chat, we had quite a few people pop in and out of our live recording here, and I'll try to get them all. We have Russ, KC5CNT, Darren, VK6EK, Bill, KD9HLN, Ted, WA0EIR, Tony, K4XSS, Jill, K1TTZ, Nymandem, Joel, KC0YEW, Steve, KJ5T, and John, K1BTZ.
All right, very good. And apparently I somehow missed Mastodon. We actually had people join us on Mastodon.
Oh.
we had at Jax, J-A-C-K-S, and at SP9UNB. So I wanted to make sure we get those in there. I'll, of course, add that to the show notes and make sure that you are all duly recognized. So with that, we have come down to the end of the program. We want to thank everybody who listens to the show. We really appreciate it. And everybody who supports us financial. Always a help to keep the lights on and especially get us to going to our yearly trip to Hamvention. We definitely appreciate it. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap this one up and wish you a good week and hope you'll tune in and join us for the Weekender next time around. It's sure to be a good time. So take care, everybody. And we're going to get on out of here. For the absent, Cheryl, W5MOO. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD73.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a community-sponsored podcast. Our website is located at lhspodcast.info. You can support the podcast by visiting the LHS Patreon page at patreon.com/LHSpodcast or by using the contribute list on the homepage. We have a presence on Discord, Facebook, IRC, Twitter, and YouTube. You can also drop us an email at info@lhspodcast.info or leave us a voicemail at 1-909-LHS-SHOW. That's 1-909-547-7469. Visit the online LHS merchandise store at shop.lhspodcast.info for fun and fashionable show-themed merchandise. Until next time, remember to always heed your hedonism.